Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by Dmitry Alperovich. He is the chairman and the founder of Silverado Policy Accelerator. It's a think tank based in Washington, D.C. He is the co-founder of CrowdStrike, also the former CTO as well. And I wanted to invite him on my show to kind of go over the whole war in Ukraine situation. He was one of the few people that I know personally who called the war few months back in December. He had a long Twitter post where he said he was convinced that he thought Russia was had decided actually to invade Ukraine even at that time. So I'm kind of fascinated by the insights that Dmitry has with Russia, Ukraine, and most importantly, I want to try to gain some insights into the future of where all this could unfold. So Dmitry, welcome on the show. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great. So first off, I wanted to ask, regarding your kind of prediction that Russia would invade Ukraine, this was back in December. Can you kind of share what was your kind of your key insight? What was the tipping point, that the point that you said this is the reason why I think, you know, Russia is going to invade Ukraine?
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me. So the first thing that was clearly an indicator that too many people decided to ignore for some amazing reasons is that Russia was building, it was clear at the time, even in early December, the largest invasion force that Europe has seen since the late 60s, when the Soviet Union at the time, along with the Warsaw Pact, had invaded Czechoslovakia. So that was sort of clue one. And a lot of people pretended that either it wasn't happening or it was done as a bluff. The problem with the bluff hypothesis was, though, that Putin wasn't getting anything for it. It was very clear that his demands, which I thought were real demands about Ukraine having neutrality with regards to joining NATO and even ultimately the EU, were going absolutely nowhere, that no one was actually giving him any substantive concessions that he was looking for. And in many ways, looking at Putin, particularly over the last 8 years, it was becoming very clear to me that he felt that Ukraine has gone off the rails in many ways, of course, due to the actions he himself had undertook back then when he annexed Crimea, when he started an insurgency in the Donbas region. And as a result of that, he really pushed Ukraine towards the West. Ukraine was getting much more integrated in NATO, even though it was not formally a member. You started to see NATO weapons in Ukraine, such as the Javelin deliveries in the last few years, anti-tank weapons. You saw NATO advisors and trainers and even intelligence reconnaissance capabilities being deployed within Ukraine. So Putin was observing all of this, and it was pretty clear to me that he was not only not happy about it, but determined to change that status quo. And I believe that looking at all of the elements that he was assembling from a military perspective, we now know that he assembled 75% of the battalion tactical groups that Russia has in its entire military along the borders of Ukraine, that he brought enormous air force capabilities, electronic warfare, even bridge building capabilities. So it's clear to me that that was not a bluff, that this was a preparation for an invasion. And the reasons that he was announcing to the world and to the West in the negotiations about what he wanted from Ukraine were real reasons. Like, we could debate whether they were legitimate or not, and certainly some of the things are pretty outrageous in terms of what he's demanding. But it was clear to me that he believed in it, and he thought that he deserved to get them. And I thought that he was going to use military force to get it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So to summarize, you're saying, okay, you saw this big, you know, moving of forces to the border, invasion forces with all the supplies and infrastructure. You gave validity to the demands of Putin, where you thought he was serious. He really wanted Ukraine out of NATO and EU, or the possibility of joining NATO and EU off the table. And also Putin saw the unfolding of the kind of, I guess, the military equipment, the weapons coming into Ukraine, the Javelins, the Stingers, even the Turkey, let's say the TB2 drones, all of this perhaps heightened the urgency on Putin's side. Is that kind of the angle that you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It was clear to me that he was determined to change the status quo. He wasn't going to get it through diplomatic efforts. He wasn't really engaged in diplomacy in a serious fashion. The publication of those draft treaties, if you recall, back in December was something that you just don't see in international affairs. That's not how you start a negotiation, by publishing the text of what you want to see. That never works. The military that he built was a military prepared to invade, and I thought that he would use it. And the other thing that, of course, becomes sort of a self-sustaining prophecy, if you will, is that when you build a force like this, it makes it very, very difficult to pull it back without losing face. It makes it very difficult to keep it there. It was pretty clear to me that the logistics that they had were just not sustainable for keeping that force there for many months. You would start to get degradation of capabilities on the equipment side. The training of the force would atrophy as well. You would have serious morale issues. So that was not sustainable. So he would either have to use it or he would have to pull back. And given that he wasn't going to get any of what he set out to have as his objectives diplomatically, it was pretty clear to me he was going to launch the war, and he did.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think Putin went in now? What was the urgency of, let's say, you know, early 2022 versus waiting a few years, you know, 2024, 2026? Why is it now? Do you think it was, you know, one angle is just the militarization of just Ukraine getting more high-tech weapons, becoming more effective? He's thinking maybe it'll be harder later, that there's already this momentum of losing Ukraine to the West, and he needs to, I guess, the best opportunity would be, you know, earlier, but he's thinking it's better now than later, which would be even more difficult. Like, what's the rationale, you think, that Putin kind of ended up deciding to go in right now versus just waiting longer?
So one important thing to realize here is that this was not a sudden invasion. It's not like he woke up and early December decided to do this buildup. That buildup had started over a year ago, probably last February, maybe even January, and obviously continued through the spring. There was a little bit of a pause in the summertime frame when he had that famous meeting with Biden in Geneva, but then restarted shortly thereafter in the fall. And you know, everyone started paying attention to it late November when you saw sort of massive troop movements, massive equipment movements in particular on the rails, even going all the way from Vladivostok and in the Far East to the Crimean, Ukrainian borders. And it was pretty clear that he's been planning this for some time. And I think there were a number of elements that went into the timing question. One is that Russia actually genuinely did have a lot of hopes for Zelensky when he got elected. He got elected on this platform that he's going to bring peace to the Donbas region, that he's going to find some sort of accommodation with Russia. And then when he got into office, he realized that the politics of Ukraine just did not allow that to happen. And in many ways, he started cracking down on the use of Russian language in eastern Ukraine. He started cracking down on the pro-Russia politicians, particularly this oligarch Medvedchuk that Putin is very close to. He's actually godfather to one of his daughters. Zelensky put that man under house arrest. So they started to see things going in a completely different direction from what they wanted to see, from what they expected. And at the same time, you know, Putin is looking at his legacy. He's going to be 70 years old this year. Ukraine is the unsolved problem for him, of course, in that he thinks that he lost Ukraine back in 2014 when, in his mind, he allowed the Maidan to take place, and he needed to fix that. And the only option he had left was military force. And at the same time, you know, as you mentioned, you did have Ukraine getting closer to NATO. You did have the military infrastructure in Ukraine being more and more significant in terms of the weaponry that it was getting. So it would only get harder with time. So I think they just decided that 2022 was as good time as any, and the sooner the better.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. What do you think was Putin's initial political objective? Like, what was his intended scenario? Obviously, war unfolds many unknown, you know, possibilities, but what was the original kind of default plan, you think, of invading? How long, what kind of timeline do you think that they were expecting initially?
Yeah, so it's very clear now that their assumptions about this war were completely wrong. It appears that Putin truly believed that he could take this country on the cheap, the largest country in Europe, aside from Russia. He believed that because Zelensky's ratings prior to the war were very low in the mid to low 20s, that unpopularity translated in his mind into popularity of Russia, which of course was nonsense. And it's pretty clear that he wanted to change the regime in Ukraine, that he wanted to install a pro-Russian regime. The way he even refused to mention Zelensky's name was an attempt to delegitimize him. He always talked about the regime in Kiev, the junta in Kiev, as some of the people around him have started referring to the government. And of course, when he did announce the invasion, he talked about it as a denazification effort, as if the Zelensky, who by the way is Jewish, is some sort of Nazi running Ukraine. So all that makes me very convinced that he wanted to install a pro-Russian regime, perhaps even with Medvedchuk, this oligarch that was under house arrest, has now escaped house arrest in Kiev, running the government. That, of course, went out the window with this disastrous campaign that has turned most of the Ukrainian population squarely against Russia. And I don't believe that he can actually achieve those objectives anymore.
Mm-hmm. All right. So fast forward, let's say, from the invasion, it's like almost, you know, it's been 2 weeks. There's been a fierce, you know, Ukrainian resistance. The West has come in with aid, with weapons and support. How does this change the equation for Putin, and what are his best options right now going forward? Like you're saying before, his option was like probably a quick regime change, right? He was expecting less resistance. But now that people are fiercely fighting, you know, for their land, and it's becoming a brutal war, how do you see the equation changing, or how has it changed for Putin?
Well, there's a question of how it has to change, and whether he has actually realized that it is changing. You have to remember, this is only day 12 of the campaign, still very early on, and he may still think that his maximalist goal of regime change is achievable in Ukraine, even though it's becoming very obvious to many people that there's just no way it can even be remotely possible. But if he ever does realize that, I think that at a minimum, he would still insist on recognition of Crimea as Russian territory, so Ukraine having to give up any rights to the peninsula. He would insist on some form of neutrality for Ukraine, where there would be a change to the constitution to not join NATO or EU, some sort of demilitarization of Ukraine, where it can no longer receive EU weapons or training, and potentially recognition of the Donbass, although it's not clear to me that that is really an important issue for him, at least as important as the others. The problem, of course, with all of that is that these terms are completely unacceptable to Zelensky and the Ukrainian people. So I don't see any possible compromise in the near future along those grounds. And the challenge that Vladimir Putin now faces is that he's all in. He's gambled everything on this adventure in Ukraine, including his own survival, his own regime's survival, and he cannot pull back. If he pulls back without accomplishing anything and suffering thousands of casualties and unleashing this horrendous human rights catastrophe on Ukraine, completely isolating Russia diplomatically and on the way to doing so economically, he will lose. He will lose power. So he has to double down and keep going in the hopes of achieving something, even if that something is not really achievable.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's a quandary in some sense. It's like Putin, I think one of the issues I wanted to get your feedback also is on this issue of Russia kind of foregoing the information propaganda campaign to get more countries, get global opinion on its side before going into Ukraine. I think one of the results is like, it's been this global war on the global platform where everyone's looking at this, but they're seeing the brutality on the Russian side as the aggressors, and the global opinion is siding with Ukraine. And this is, I think, in some ways, it's tightening the options. Like Russia doesn't have as many options as they would have if global opinion was more split. Let's say if it was split half and half, there could be sanctions, but then half the world might not give sanctions to Russia. They could rely on something else, another block of countries to depend on. But with global opinion so tilted to Ukraine, it just seems like there's not much leverage that Putin has at this point besides military force, you know, on Ukraine. I mean, what other kind of leverage points do you think Russia can pull at this point? Like, do they just continue to double down until they get some type of concession out of Zelensky in Ukraine? Or do they just, is it a possibility they just call it quits eventually? They say, hey, we're pulling back a ceasefire, but then it just stalls and it just never kind of continues on from there?
I find it hard to believe that you're going to have a ceasefire situation that results in Putin leaving without accomplishing anything. And at the same time, I find it hard to believe that he can actually accomplish anything. He can certainly destroy Kiev, and he may very well end up doing so. But it's not clear to me that he can actually hold Kiev, that he can actually occupy even part of Ukraine, given the enormous resistance that he's encountering in pretty much all the cities that the Russians are entering, even the cities up north that are, you know, people have thought are pro-Russian. They're right near the Russian border. People speak Russian. And yet, you know, the Ukrainian nationalist dreams and character are very strong. And people are rightly seeing the Russian military as coming in as occupiers. And they're protesting. They're lying in front of the armored vehicles and preventing them from going forward. That can very quickly turn into violent insurgency, and probably will as the occupation continues. So he doesn't have many options. And in many ways, it's a sunk cost fallacy that, you know, you've already lost a lot on the economic sphere. You know, the Russian economy is going to go into a very deep economic hole, given what has occurred from a sanctions perspective, but even more importantly, from the corporate perspective, corporations making individual decisions to get out of Russia. And, you know, at this point, he just has to keep going in the hopes of accomplishing something. In some ways, this is a do-or-die moment for him. And I want to speak a little bit about the economic situation, because I think that not only Putin himself and those around him have been shocked by the response, but frankly, it's been surprising, I think, to even many observers, the fact that the Europeans in particular would be so strong on both sanctions, the fact that the companies would go far beyond what the U.S. government, the European governments have been doing on the sanctions front, which, while severe, has mostly focused on the financial sector and hasn't even covered the whole financial sector, only some of the major banks, not even all of them. The oil and gas industry is mostly untouched by sanctions still. And yet you're seeing all of the major Western giants, from software, from fintech, from entertainment, from consulting, deciding unilaterally that they're going to pull out. I think in many ways, in response to the pressure from their own employees that are seeing the pictures and the war crimes that Russia is committing in Ukraine and demanding that they pull out. In other ways, realizing that it's going to be much harder to do business in Russia, given the sanctions that are already in place and those that are likely to go into place. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, when the airlines stop flying to Russia, when the companies like DHL stop shipping packages to Russia, you know, it becomes harder to do business there, and you just decide that the benefits are not worth the cost, the political cost, the PR cost, the regulatory costs, and companies are pulling out. And the more that are pulling out, the more pressure it creates on others to pull out. So pretty soon, you're not going to have any Western companies left in Russia. I think we're well on the way towards that situation. And it's going to be devastating for them, because it's really hard to keep an isolated economy, particularly an economy that has been really well integrated into the West. It is a $1.5 trillion economy. And to have it almost overnight go to zero in terms of that integration is going to be very painful for the middle class. Very painful, obviously, for the oligarchs that are in Russia, and is going to create real political pressures on Putin, and may actually result in a coup that removes him from power.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, yeah, it's interesting, because, like, even just a few weeks ago, most people, you know, observers or people in the know, really didn't think a coup would be a possibility a few weeks ago. They wouldn't even talk about it. But now,
I thought there was zero chance of a coup up until February 24th. Right. Mm-hmm. Up until he invaded, and when we saw the response from the West, companies and governments, that's when I thought that the chance was no longer zero. It's still small. You still have to appreciate that the repression apparatus that Putin has built is really impressive and really strong. So it's not easy to pull off a coup in that country, but it is no longer zero.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, on the economic repercussions, I mean, you bring up a few things. One is not just sanctions, but also the voluntary kind of withdrawing of Western companies across the board. I mean, it's been like a flurry of companies just announcement after announcement. You had Visa and MasterCard recently. Even this morning, I heard Upwork, and just, I mean, they're already, so much of just the Western economy in terms of private businesses have already announced, and it likely, as you're saying, will continue as the war continues. What does I mean? Do you think that has a bigger impact than the current government sanctions, or do you think the government sanctions, have a different kind of side of impact in terms of Russia's kind of economic pain that they feel?
The reality is the sanctions would not be as severe if you did not have this voluntary exodus of companies. If you didn't have insurance companies pulling out of Russia and deciding not to insure Aeroflot planes, which literally shut down Aeroflot, it is no longer flying any routes except domestically into Belarus. Huge impact on the country. If you didn't have the airline leasing companies deciding to break their contracts with Russia, sanctions did make them do that. They could still figure out a way to get paid through banks that are not yet sanctioned. The airline industry was not under sanctions, but yet you have all those companies unilaterally deciding that it's not worth it to continue doing business with a regime that is clearly now completely a totalitarian regime. It used to be authoritarian, now it's a totalitarian. And that is having a much greater impact on their economy than I think they ever expected.
Yeah, interesting. What are your thoughts on this? So I was thinking this past few days that the big kind of sanction step change would be if the U.S. and the West basically sanctioned countries that are trading with Russia, basically sanctions on the level of North Korea or Iran, and China comes up in mind where. They seem to be kind of tiptoeing around this whole issue of Russia and Ukraine a bit. And they probably don't want to be, subject to possible US sanctions against China if this thing continues to go on, if US boosts their sanctions to, trading partners of Russia. So I'm kind of like thinking a few things along this route. So first, what's your kind of prognosis on the timeline of, do you think US will take that step to, actually sanction countries that are trading with Russia? Or will it take something big to happen? Like, for example, I was thinking if Putin ever, chooses to use a nuclear weapon immediately, that puts Russia up to the highest of all sanctions. They'll be cut off from everything. And then it basically puts the whole world at war, where at least the Western world will attack Russia. It pretty much seems like a death sentence in terms of Russia's economy and, the current regime of Russia. So I don't, on one hand, I feel like there's even like Putin is talking about nuclear weapons. I want to ask you about this as another question. It just seems like the scenario of him using a nuclear weapon when the whole world is against him, meaning he doesn't have a separate one-third of the world that's really cheering him on, that he could rely on for, economic trade after the nuclear weapon goes off. It just seems like a nuclear weapon would be annihilation for the Russian economy and the Russian state. So I don't know if that's really like a
Yeah.
plausible, situation. So what are your thoughts kind of on those two topics, like nuclear weapons, right, as leverage, but also kind of the future of these sanctions? How far can these sanctions go?
Yeah, I'm not one of those people that is worried about him using a nuclear weapon. I think that's a very unrealistic prospect of that, thank goodness. This is not a man that's suicidal. In fact, all you have to do is look at the videos of him in the last few weeks sitting 30 feet away from any one of his cabinet officials because he's, completely afraid of COVID. So this is not a guy that's going to pull the trigger on a nuclear weapon strike against NATO or the US, knowing that it will result in his own demise. And he also does not need to use tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Russia has plenty of conventional firepower to pulverize most Ukrainian cities without having to resort to nukes. So I don't see nukes at all being part of the equation here. For him, obviously, you know, if there's a conflict between NATO and Russia, God forbid, then anything could be on the table. But I think we'll be able to avoid that. He certainly doesn't want it. I don't think we want it. So hopefully cooler heads will prevail, and that will not be a reality. When it comes to China, you know, China is not, you know, a deep friend of Russia. China is a friend of convenience for Russia. They need Russia. They need Russia's resources. They need Russia in terms of confronting the West and the United States. But they don't have a deep affinity for Russia. And when it comes to this conflict, they just don't want to get involved. They want to continue focusing on their own economy. They've got, you know, COVID issues, obviously, that they're trying to clamp down on. They still have this ridiculous zero COVID policy that they're trying to keep in place. Xi Jinping has the party Congress that's coming up in October. So the last thing he wants to do is get involved in someone else's conflict, someone else's war. So they want to stay far away from it, and they want to see how they can opportunistically benefit from it. One benefit they've already received is that everyone stopped paying attention to China. You know, for the last year, the Biden administration has wanted to pivot to Asia, repeat the, sort of the promise of the Obama administration to do this pivot. And they spent the last year talking about Russia and now dealing with this invasion. So the Chinese are loving that, the fact that they can sort of be operating away from the spotlight and doing whatever they want in Xinjiang, in Hong Kong, and continue to focus on their economic growth. So that's number one. Number two, they're opportunistically looking at Russia. As Western companies are pulling out of Russia, they're thinking that they can get some bargain prices for some good deals in Russia on some typically Chinese exorbitant terms. And I'm sure they will grab whatever they can. They are going to pay attention to U.S. sanctions. I don't think they're going to violate those sanctions willy-nilly. But, you know, sanctions, even if they're secondary sanctions, are going to be pretty specific. We're not going to sanction all of China. We're going to sanction specific companies that may be working with Russia. And some of those companies may be more immune to our sanctions than others. So I think it's going to be case-by-case basis of whether there's going to be sanction busting on the part of China or Chinese companies and the degree of that sanction busting. The reality is that China already engages in sanction busting when it comes to North Korea. Iran mostly does it covertly on a low scale. So you may see a lot of that in Russia, where there's a black market for goods that Russia cannot get right now directly from the West that would be coming in through China. Goods like semiconductors, for example, and other technologies that they may need for their own domestic industries.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So I want to go back into what you were talking about earlier about the conditions that Russia has set out to end the war, or just, you know, the different demands. And you're saying how these demands are unrealistic to be accepted by Zelensky and Ukraine. But I want to go through them one by one and get your feedback on, like, what are the chances, you know, that these both sides can come to an agreement? Just from your perspective, you know, how far are they away? So you listed about, I think, five of them. So the first one is Crimea, to, you know, for Russia to get acknowledgement, right, that Crimea is Russian land. What's your take? Is Zelensky, Ukraine, is this 0% possibility? Is there any possibility that this, you know, gets ceded over to Russia?
I think very unlikely. And look, you know, the reality is that the Ukrainians have had significant successes in holding back the Russian military and inflicting a lot of pain on them, a lot of casualties. So even though they are obviously suffering tremendously under the bombardment of the Russian forces, I think they are more convinced than ever that they could, you know, win this war by holding out. So I think the likelihood that they'll accept any of these conditions, quite frankly, is very, very low.
Interesting. So Crimea, how about neutrality? So I think I was reading, you know, Russia's wanting neutrality written into their constitution. Is this a possibility? Is Ukraine open to this, or is this out of the question?
Again, they rejected it before the invasion. I don't know that why they would accept it now that the invasion has occurred, now that they've been able to punish the Russians severely for this incursion, this war that they're prosecuting on Ukraine. So I don't think that that is really on the table, at least at a level that Russia wants, right? So Russia wants permanent rejection of NATO and EU. It would be very hard sell for Zelensky to offer that to the Ukrainian public. Their admirations are with the West. Their dreams are with the West. They will be crushed if after all of the suffering, after all of the sacrifices, that would be the end result. I don't see that as remotely possible.
Got it. Also with demilitarization, like, it seems like Russia is proving that to Ukraine, at least from Ukraine's perspective, that they need militarization, right? Because if they agree to this so-called demilitarization of the state, taking all their weapons, like, they're basically sitting ducks, right, for Russia in the future, whether it's 5 or 10 or 20 years down the road. So, I mean, demilitarization seems like another one of these tough sells for Ukraine. Like, I don't see how they're going to accept that as part of, you know, a peace deal. What's your take on that?
Yeah, this is the one area where the Russians may be willing to compromise some, because, frankly, they're destroying a lot of military equipment from that is Ukrainian right now, with their airstrikes and artillery. So they may be able to say in some sort of face-saving measure that, well, we demilitarized Ukraine ourselves. We don't need them to agree to this. But at least on NATO and the EU and on Crimea, I don't think they're going to negotiate.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And how about the eastern regions? Is Zelensky and Ukraine adamant that they're not going to cede these over to Russia?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Russian demands are maximalist in those regions. So not only do they recognize kind of the regions as the borders are, or at least were defined before this war, for those Luhansk and Donetsk regions, but they recognize them in their maximum areas that existed pre-2014, many of which are still occupied by Ukrainians that want no part of Russia. So I don't see that Ukrainian ceding on that point at all.
Hmm. Wow. So, I mean, if you're looking at this as, you know, the Ukrainians aren't likely to cede pretty much any of these demands from Russia, what are the scenarios for peace then? Like, how do things get resolved? Yeah, I mean, one kind of road that I'm seeing here is perhaps there's a possibility that things go very, very wrong for Russia, where it turns out that they have to give Crimea over, basically give everything over to Ukraine in exchange for reparations, you know, for war reparations, because things have just, like, the whole country has been, infrastructure has been demolished in many senses. So, I mean, is that a possibility, you think, that the tide can turn?
No, I mean, first of all, mm-hmm. Russia is not going to have the money pretty soon to pay any reparations. Mm-hmm. But look, I don't see a prospect for a quick peace here. We may have some ceasefires that are likely to be broken, but I think Putin is committed to pursuing his objectives. And, you know, I think he's either going to remove Zelensky from power through military force, or he himself is going to lose power. And mm-hmm. this conflict can drag out for a while.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Do you think if Zelensky is taken out, assassinated, bombed, or whatever, killed, do you think things change?
No, because whoever replaces him is going to pursue the same policies and is going to probably keep fighting the same fight that Zelensky is doing right now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, so let's dive into this a bit more. Let's say, you know, this war is just, you know, day 12 or 13 or so. If it continues on to, let's say, you know, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, I mean, we're talking about just massive amounts of casualties, brutality. It's just, you know, unending in some senses. I mean, at a certain point, do you think, you know, like, do you think Russia can reach a point where they're like, hey, this is just too much, or we're out of here? Or Ukraine reaches a point where, like, this is just too much death, let's cede Crimea at least, or let's do something, you know, to appease Russia, just end the death. What's your take on which side actually will cede first?
You know, it's really hard to predict. The more brutal that Russia becomes, the more that it looks to turn Kyiv, which is, you know, in a remarkable city, remarkable European city with a deep history and connection to Russia, sort of the historically believed to be the start of the Russian people and the Russian Empire. If that city is destroyed, not only will he be roundly condemned, deservedly so, by the world community, but it would be a pretty hard sell even to the Russian population. And this war is deeply unpopular in Russia. And, you know, that is why you're seeing him resort to very brutal methods and complete totalitarian methods to try to suppress dissent, to shut down the remaining media, independent media that still existed in Russia up until about a week ago. All that is now gone. You have the introduction of these brutal laws through the Russian parliament that he signed last week that penalize anyone who is spreading quote-unquote fake news about Russian military for 15 years. And, of course, the Russian government decides with 15 years in prison, and the Russian government decides what fake news means. So pretty much anyone that wants to talk about the military campaign in Ukraine or anything related to Russia's prosecution of the war risks going to jail for 15 years if they run if they say something that the Russian government dislikes. And that's why you're seeing foreign media pull out. BBC, CNN, and others have left the country because their reporters have left the country because they don't believe that they can safely cover this war anymore from Russia and not risk imprisonment of their own people. So it's going to be very difficult for him to sustain this war and try to achieve his objectives. I don't think his objectives are at all achievable, and not lose his hold on power. So he's in a catch-22. He can't pull back because he may lose power because of it. But if he keeps prosecuting the war, he may lose power as well.
Mm-hmm. Got it. What's your take on this whole thing of Russia? Are they pulling their access of kind of, is it, are they with internet, are they pulling free access to the internet? Will everything have to go through Russian servers? Will they be monitoring that? Like, have you been following kind of the whole internet thing going on there?
So Russia is not going to voluntarily disconnect itself from the internet. In fact, what it is doing is preparing for potential disconnection by the West of Russia from the internet. So Ukraine has applied to international organizations that regulate the distribution of top-level domains like .us, .ru, and so forth, .ua, and asked for the .ru domain to be revoked from Russia. It requested that the IP space, the internet address space, allocated to Russia be revoked as well. Those things are unlikely to happen, but the Russians clearly haven't seen really severe sanctions already imposed on them. Western corporations pulling out are concerned about that possibility, and they're trying to prepare for it.
Mm, okay.
But one thing that we are seeing is, the great firewall of Russia, if you will, go up and start censoring and blocking many Western sites. They've already blocked Facebook. They've already blocked Twitter. TikTok actually voluntarily pulled out in the last couple of days. So you're seeing access to information on the internet being severely restricted by the Russian people.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Your background, you were a CTO of CrowdStrike for many years, and one of the top cybersecurity companies. What's your kind of angle in terms of cybersecurity communications when you look at this war? For example, how important is kind of the communications internally in Ukraine to maintain for them to have a better fighting chance against Russia? And how important, for example, we have, recent news of Starlink, kind of SpaceX sending Starlink dishes to try to help out that. Is that crucial, or is that just more complementary? What can you kind of give some insights into maybe the battle behind the communications infrastructure that perhaps most of us aren't aware of or aren't seeing?
Well, communications are always critical. Communications are critical, of course, from a military perspective, tactically communicating with units across Ukraine that are fighting the Russians. It's critical to use communications like television, radio, etc., to communicate with the population, let them know about what's happening. And then communication to the outside world, particularly for the government to continue raising awareness of the issues that Ukraine are facing, ask for help. Military help, humanitarian assistance, and the like. So it is really, really important. And I've actually been surprised that the Russians have not knocked out the communication infrastructure in Ukraine. in the early days of the conflict. It turns out that apparently they were reliant on it themselves. You see now a lot of videos of Russian soldiers that are using their own cell phones for communication, civilian radios and the like. And that appears to have been part of the reason why they haven't attacked the Ukrainian communication infrastructure. But they're starting to do that now. They've taken out television antennas, towers in Kyiv and Kharkiv through airstrikes. You're seeing some local jamming activity in a number of cities, so mobile service is getting degraded. When it comes to Starlink, I'm somewhat concerned, actually, about Starlink. I mean, on one hand, obviously, kudos to Elon for providing those terminals to the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians have been asking for them. On the other hand, because very few people in Ukraine have access to Starlink terminals, and most of the people that are using them are members of Zelensky's government, that creates an opportunity for Russia to target them because they can identify those signals through their enormous signals intelligence collection capability. They can triangulate them and they can target them, assuming that anyone that's using Starlink terminals is going to be a high-value target.
Got it. How accurately can they target the actual terminals? Can they target it to a specific GPS coordinate where they can send a missile directly to that coordinate?
Yeah, I mean, they can triangulate that fairly accurately. And, you know, of course, their bombs are not super accurate, as we've seen, so they can go off course, but they can also take down whole buildings and, you know, can cause a lot of casualties.
Got it. Is there anything that SpaceX can do to kind of skirt that, you know, to kind of, I don't know, confuse, you know, the Russians at all?
Well, if you sort of start flooding the country with terminals and everyone is using terminals, not just people in government or military, then it becomes harder for the Russians to understand, you know, whether the signal that they're tracking is affiliated with a high value target or not. So, you know, in some ways, giving as many terminals as possible to Ukraine would help to diminish some of that risk. Mm-hmm.
Got it. Yeah, I would imagine, like, I wonder if they're already doing stuff where they have a terminal, but then they're running like long cables or even Wi-Fi repeaters or something to distance themselves from, you know, the actual reception or the actual dish. I mean,
My understanding, I'm not an expert on Starlink, but my understanding is that because the network cable is also the power cable, there's a very short distance that you can be away from the dish. So I'm not sure that that's practical, but I'm not an expert on Starlink, so I'm confident in that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there might be I should have one right outside, actually. Actually, I have a router right here. I have a Starlink router right here. I guess this is the power cord. I guess the power cord is the actual... Yeah, router.
I thought there was like 100 feet distance maximum.
Yeah.
The dish, but
yeah. Okay, I asked on Twitter some of my followers for some questions here, and so I'll go through a few of them. Zuma says, "How do you see this war ending? What are some possible scenarios and percent chances that you ascribe to those scenarios?" So, obviously, in war, every day, like every week, is changing. We don't know, like, situations, the percentages all change, so we have to provide a disclaimer in the sense this is just our own present day right now personal opinion on scenarios that will change tomorrow and next week. That said, you know, what is today's date? March 7th, you know, 2022. What do you think are the top two or three, you know, possible scenarios? At what percent kind of do you ascribe percent kind of probabilities to those scenarios?
You know, there's just too much uncertainty right now to give predictions with chances of outcome. I'll tell you the likely scenarios are, likely possibilities, I should say, are that there's going to be a coup in Russia and Putin is removed from power and whoever comes next decides to end this war. Second scenario is that they're going to move forward and they're going to lay siege to Kyiv and unleash utter barbarity and brutality on that city and kill lots and lots of civilians. As a result of that, they may get perhaps Zelensky in an act of desperation or others to make some concessions. I think unlikely, but you can't discount that possibility. And the third possibility, which I think is unfortunately the most likely one, is that this will continue for a long time, that there will be a long insurgency that will continue to bleed the Russian forces, but they can sustain it for years. And it's going to obviously cause a lot of civilian casualties. It's going to destroy the Ukrainian infrastructure. Unfortunately, I think that's probably the most likely scenario.
Mm-hmm. And it'll harm, you know, the Russian economy and, yeah, the Russian people along the way.
Well, the Russian economy has already been harmed. Mm-hmm. The effects of that, they're going to feel over a long period of time. It won't be an instant sort of cutoff. But there's no going back from that. Those sanctions, those companies, I don't think are going back into Russia in any foreseeable future, no matter what happens in Ukraine. So that's really sunk cost for Putin at this point. I don't think he's looking at that at all in terms of thinking of how he's going to prosecute this campaign.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Glenn Little says, did Putin or Russia believe that the West would attack or invade Russia if Russia didn't strike first? Does he see this action as a defense against that? So I guess back to motivations, like why did Putin, you know, invade Ukraine? Was he thinking at some time in the future, you know, Ukraine would join NATO or the EU, that they would somehow not just attack or subvert the government, maybe? When, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I mean, he did believe that Ukraine was on the path to join NATO, maybe on a long path, but nevertheless, I mean, we gave him all the reasons to believe that. In 2008, we had a declaration at the NATO summit in Bucharest that said that Ukraine and Georgia will join NATO. That was a direct statement from NATO countries. And since then, we've been reaffirming that. As recently as last October, Secretary of Defense Austin was in Kyiv saying that we look forward to the day when Ukraine becomes a part of NATO. So, you know, and we've been saying that publicly for years. I don't know why people are surprised that Putin would believe our own statements. Mm. So, yes, he thought that Ukraine would eventually become part of NATO. And the one thing he realized, and that's really important that most people don't appreciate, is that Ukraine, there's only one thing that's worse than Ukraine being in NATO, and that's Ukraine not being in NATO. Because what's been happening over the last few years is that Ukraine got deeply integrated with Western militaries in terms of advisors, in terms of trainers. If you looked at the flight radar information over Ukraine over the last few months, you would almost on a 24/7 basis would see U.S. Air Force reconnaissance planes that would be flying up north along the border, collecting intelligence on Russians. Russians were fully aware of that taking place. And, you know, the weapons like javelins and others that Ukraine would be receiving throughout this time. So on one hand, you don't have the mutual self-defense agreement of Article 5 between NATO and Ukraine, but you have a lot of infrastructure mm-hmm. that is going into Ukraine, that was going into Ukraine. And if you're Putin, it's only natural to assume that even more would be going in the future. And you don't have any of the constraining power of NATO. So, you know, NATO is, you know, a massive bureaucracy with all these countries really trying to make decisions mostly with unanimous consent, which makes it, you know, very risk averse and in many ways constraining in terms of its ability to do adventures. And Ukraine was not constrained by any of that because it wasn't a member of NATO. So you had all the downsides of NATO from Russian perspective and none of the upsides. You know, reality is that we can argue all day long that NATO was not a threat to Russia, that NATO is a defensive alliance, but Russia, and, you know, with some reason, brings up the cases of Kosovo, the cases of Libya, that NATO did engage in bombing campaigns in over the last 20 plus years. And those countries obviously weren't a threat to NATO. Now, we can say we did it for humanitarian purposes, but that's no consolation to Vladimir Putin that you know, engages in extreme brutality at home and abroad. So the idea that NATO would intervene potentially for humanitarian reasons is not something that gives him any consolation. And then you also have the historical argument, which is very powerful in the minds of the Russian people, that when you look at most of the invasions that Russia has suffered over hundreds of years of history, whether it's Hitler, whether it's Napoleon, whether it's the Teutonic Knights, whether it's the Swedes, the Poles, that have all been invading Russia and trying to occupy Moscow, virtually all of those invasions have come either through Belarus or Ukraine. So the idea that those countries would not be buffer zones for Russia is very difficult for any ruler to comprehend, much less someone like Vladimir Putin.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Jacob Yuri says Putin has declared much of the Western support to Ukraine to be an act of war. What does What do you believe is Putin's line in the sand that would make him decide to attack a NATO country? So I guess to
Yeah,
expand
I
on this
think.
question a bit is kind of, US, the West, they're sending missiles, they're sending aircraft, anti-tank stuff, they're sending even fighter jets. At what point does it become like, Putin says, "Hey, you're attacking, basically, we're in a war," and Russia lashes out on a NATO country. Do you think that's even a possibility?
Well, again, we don't have to guess. He's been very clear in the last week of what his red lines are. He said that if there is any enforcement of a no-fly zone by any country, that he will consider that country combatant and will attack that country. If there is infrastructure within that country that's used to attack Russia and Ukraine, they'll consider that a combatant. So there was talk early on about the planes from Poland and Bulgaria and other countries being based in Poland and flying from Poland. I think that was a very reckless idea because Russia would absolutely target those bases. And we would get a war between Poland and Russia, which of course would involve the rest of NATO in a heartbeat. So those are, I think, are the scenarios. Now you might see them start targeting the convoys of weapon supplies in Ukraine. And then we've seen them in the past go after in a covert fashion the warehouses that are used in NATO countries to supply Ukraine. So there was, of course, a famous case of GRU officers, Russian military intelligence officers, using chemical weapons to poison an arms supply in Bulgaria that was sending weapons to Ukraine, and then stage a fire in a warehouse in Czech Republic where those weapons were stored, in the process killing a few innocent people. I think they would fully engage in those types of acts of sabotage to try to disrupt the supply of weapons into Ukraine.
Got it. A few kind of rapid questions going into your personal background. So I know you've been involved with cybersecurity for a long time. Before CrowdStrike, you were at McAfee, I believe. And I think you just recently left CrowdStrike, right? Just like in 2020, was it? When you left to start your think tank, Silverado Policy Accelerators. So a few questions on this. So what does kind of Silverado Policy Accelerators do? But a follow-up question more is like, what moved you from the private tech world, where I'm sure there was a lot of appeal in the sense this is business, there's growth, there's excitement, there's challenge. What made you pivot into this world of policy? Would love to hear your story.
Absolutely. So Silverado Policy Accelerator is a nonprofit geopolitical think tank here in Washington, D.C. It is focused on promoting American prosperity and competitiveness in this century and pushing policies forward that we believe can promote our prosperity and competitiveness in three areas. So the three areas that we specialize in are cybersecurity, our trade and industrial security. And then the third one is what we call an ecosec, the intersection between ecological and economic security. So as we transition to green tech in this country, how do we make sure that that presents an economic opportunity to America as opposed to a dependency on China, for example? That would be devastating for our national security. So what we do is we focus on the details. There's a lot of people in this town, a lot of great think tanks that focus on the high-level picture. We focus on the specifics of how do we actually get policies in place through executive orders, through congressional action that move the ball forward for the United States, and trying to think of proposals that are very specific and helpful that others in government can take forward. So in many ways, the reason for the name of Policy Accelerator is that we try to be sort of a venture capital type of accelerator, but for policy ideas. And incubate them and try to get them moving across the finish line. In terms of why switch careers, well, I've always been passionate about policy. I have a background in international affairs along with cybersecurity from my college days. And for the last 20 years, have not really had a lot of opportunities to apply it, given that I was an executive at significant cybersecurity companies. But having founded CrowdStrike, having taken it to become a public company, one of the largest public companies in the cybersecurity industry, it was time to sort of retire from that world after a lot of great hard work and trying to do something else, and having been fortunate, being able to apply my resources to something I'm very passionate about, which is how do we give back to this country that's been so good to me.
Interesting. What's the fear or concern that birthed Silverado? Meaning, if you didn't do Silverado policy accelerators, is there something bad you think will happen? Meaning, are we on the wrong course that Silverado policy accelerators is trying to correct? Or, you know, what's your take
on that? So it's accelerator. Core problem that we foresee is that we don't have a strategic approach to industrial policy, to cybersecurity, to ecological and economic security in this country, that we try to do things piecemeal and often don't look at the big picture. And when we face authoritarian regimes like Vladimir Putin's or Xi Jinping's in China, they do have a strategy. They do have a long-term plan. And one of the things that we're trying to bring to the table in the discussion here in Washington is sort of get people to look beyond the next 12-month budget cycle and what they should be doing in terms of resource allocations today, and thinking of what should our strategy be to outcompete China, to outcompete Russia over the long term.
Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. Sounds great. And last question is, who would you recommend that I could interview that kind of would give me some good insights into, you know, this war, but also, you know, the future ramifications? I'm having a hard time. Like, I absorb like a ton of content and views, but a lot of it just seems to come from established kind of political biased views, and they're just kind of reaffirming, you know, their own existing views, you know, on other issues. So I'm curious, like, who are some good names? Maybe people can follow you, think, on Twitter or elsewhere. That can give kind of a broader perspective and some insights into this whole situation.
Well, I think on the military side of things, Michael Kaufman and Rob Lee, I just had him on a Twitter space last night on Sunday. We'll probably do another one this weekend. Are terrific at keeping up with the Russian military, what they're up to, what their failures are, what their successes are. On broader sort of Russia relations, so there's a lot of great analysts like Matthew Rozhansky, for example, Sam Cherup, and others that have been tracking Russia for a long time and can give a lot of insights into what's happening within that country.
Okay, cool. I'll go ahead and ask you maybe for their handles or information. I'll link to that in the video description. I'll link to your Twitter profile, your think tank as well in the video description below. Anywhere else that people can find you or your work?
Twitter is a good chance to keep up with what I'm doing.
Awesome.
And Silverado Policy is the Twitter handle for Silverado.
Okay, cool. Dmitry, thanks. Great chatting with you and diving into all the stuff going on in Ukraine and the world. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Dave. Take
care. All right, we'll see ya.
Bye-bye.
Great.